Hey guys, Mike Verkes from the Second Shift Podcast here to talk to you about PIASE. Back in 1996, I had two certifications to manage, my state license and national registry. That was it. Fast forward 20-some years later, and what I would give to have just two. Between my advanced certifications, ACLS, PALS, PHTLS, you name it, I'm looking at upwards of 10 certifications to manage. That's where PIASE saves my bacon. I simply add my certs, expiration dates, and bam, no more surprises. Take pictures front and back and share those credentials with whoever needs them. With the touch of a button, it's easy. Go to the App Store now for your device and search for PIASE, P-I-A-C-E-T, PIASE. Do it today.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, welcome to the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. Mike Verkes and Eric Bauer coming to you guys live. Actually, you won't be hearing this live, but from Air Medical Transport Conference in Phoenix, Arizona. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, good, good.
Good.
Real excited about this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing story that you guys are going to hear. So if you've been to one of our review courses, you know we spend a lot of time talking about crew resource management, sort of in the CAME section, in flight emergencies and things like that. But do you ever think that that would actually happen to you? Well, we're with a crew today from the Kinder, Louisiana base from Air Evac Life Team. This is Tara and Lane. How you guys doing?
Doing good.
Hey, what's
good.
Up, Mike?
So you guys are here actually giving a presentation on what is, I think it's Managing the Unimaginable. Is that the name of your talk?
Correct. Yeah, Managing the Unimaginable.
Yeah, so you guys are going to hear this air crew talk about probably one of the most harrowing things, at least stories that I have ever heard in the HEMS industry that actually had an amazing outcome, and it could have been way different. Would you agree with that?
No, absolutely. I think that's as we were talking to this crew yesterday, you know, it's something you talk about, you wonder about, you may even joke about.
But
you never, ever imagine. So real excited to hear you guys' story.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah,
we're
absolutely.
Glad to be here.
So give us sort of the highlight of what you're here to talk about at AMTC and sort of a little bit about your guys' experience of what happened to you that day.
Yeah, so in January of this year, January 12th, normal day, normal shift, everything was going good. Weather was great. Got launched on a scene flight, about an 8-minute response from our base. Arrived on scene, found a critical patient that needed advanced airway management. We took care of her airway and got her in the aircraft, and everything's going good.
Hunky-dory, as usual.
Yeah, just, you know, normal ops, what we would consider. We depart the scene. We put our patient on the vent. Everything's going well. And then our pilot, we're trying to advise him of the destination that we're going to. Mm-hmm. And he's not responding appropriately. He's just repeating himself over and over again. He's okay, so where? To the point where we initially thought that it was an ICS issue, a comms issue. Maybe he had us isolated. Maybe he wasn't plugged in or something. So we started to sort through that and try to figure out if it was an ICS issue.
So what did that look like from your perspective, Tara? As being back there, thinking there's maybe is a comms issue, something that maybe is not that uncommon of a thing. So what was the hair on the back of your neck standing up, or was it just like, we'll just work through this?
No, not right then. It was like, okay, he can't hear us. Check the ICS switch. I hear you. You hear me. We unplugged, plugged back. And I'm sitting on the left side with the patient. Typically, that's where Elaine would sit. I manage her airway on scene, so I want to stay with her on that side. So there was a little bit of not necessarily an unfamiliarity being on that side, but because we swapped before, but it was something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like the possibility of there being a comms issue, like that wasn't a big deal. So we sat there and we just tried to figure it out, whatever. And it got to the point where we kept saying, destination hospital, and our pilot kept repeating, where? So Lane was like, unbuckle, get out your helmet, and go see what's going on.
Almost frustrated at that point, because we're trying to manage a critical patient, and it's like pilot can't hear us.
Now we got to deal with this, right?
Right. Like, just one more thing we have to deal with.
Yeah.
You know?
So, of course, we fly in a 206, which is a super small space to work in. The pilot's in my lap, basically. So I get out of my harness, I get my belt up, lean up over the patient, tap the shoulder, the pilot on the shoulder. I'm like, hey, we're going to XYZ hospital. Right. And he's just looking at me, and I can see in his mouth, he's saying, okay, where? Like, cutting me off. Okay, where? I'm telling you where. Look at
me.
And he turned away. So that's when I started to panic. That's when the hair on the back of my neck started to stand up a little bit. I got back in belts. I put my helmet back on so I can talk to Lane. I'm like, dude, something's not right.
Yeah, and at that point, my anxiety level had started to increase a lot. My heart rate started to increase because at that point, I really felt like something was wrong. We had tried to sort through what we thought was a problem and couldn't identify a solution to it. And then at that point, I realized we were actually in a left-hand turn to the point where we're very familiar with the area we fly. We were flying in the wrong direction. And we're basically flying in a left-handed circle. So at that point, I was like, something's wrong. And just my mind was telling, I need to get to the front of the aircraft. I need to, like, something's wrong. So I ended up unbuckling, and I had to take my helmet off because there's a support bar that comes over the stretcher. And I actually, unfortunately, had to crawl over our unresponsive intubated patient and managed to get to the front of the aircraft. And I did the same thing that Tara did. I tapped him on the shoulder and tried to tell him where we're going. And he looks at me, and I know everyone has experienced it. He just looked straight through me. And my heart just went in my throat because I knew at that point we had an in-flight emergency.
His eyes told that story. Lane turned around and looked at me, and it was that old expletive delete look.
Yeah.
And that's when it kicked in that this is happening.
So let's just go back for a couple of seconds. There's some high points I want to point out. I think when we look at just the management of a flight like this, I loved how you guys worked through the comms issues. I've had the same problems. Obviously, I've never had the pilot be incapacitated, but it's very, very common, especially if you have a busy patient. The pilot's going into a controlled airspace. They may have to isolate you. And in that airframe, you guys have that curtain up. You know, you can't, especially whoever's sitting in that right seat, you can't even see the pilot's head. Only person that could see is going to be in the left seat, and you would have to forwardly look over the top. So I think you guys worked through that, and I think that was great. You worked as a team. And I think the other thing is we have to remember, and we talk about this all the time in the whole different levels of hypoxia, that we all know each other. You work with those pilots. You work with each other. You know, you spend as much time with these people as you do your family.
It's a family away from family.
Yeah, and you know when something's not right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key, is we have to always remember if something doesn't seem right, we have to stop and we have to
assess that. You need to pay attention to that, because it's super easy to just go, you can't hear us, and just go about your business, right? Then we're not sitting here talking.
And from a CRM standpoint, we always try to keep that communication open, right? So even when it comes down to the little things of, hey, if you're going to isolate me, I get it. ATC's busy.
Let us know.
Let us know. Yeah. And in my mind, he had just forgot to let us know that he was isolating us. No big deal.
It's the same thing of, hey, we're going to unbuckle and move, or, hey, we just dropped a seatbelt. Let him know.
Exactly.
Hey, that was me. I just dropped a seatbelt.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is the right time. I feel like, but so I'm an EMS training officer for a large fire district in Oregon, near Portland, Oregon. And one of the things we drill on all the time is Mayday, right? And what we find is that people don't want to do the Mayday call, right? So you're up dealing with the pilot. What were you doing? Was there community? Because you had your helmet off, so you guys weren't talking, right?
We not over ICS, we were communicating.
Did you tell her it's Mayday time, or did you just inherently know that because training kicked in, or how did that work?
So
for you?
Whenever Lane went up, he gave me the look, and it's like, okay.
We were basically trying not to cry at that point because we realized what was actually happening,
and
what we believed to be a pilot having an active CVA in the cockpit of the aircraft.
Yeah. Honestly, the first thing I did was pull my phone out of my flight suit. I text my mom. I was like, I love you. I put it back in there.
Oh, gosh.
And then Lane was like, it's time. So we got up on comms and called in that Mayday call.
Wow.
And you can, if you hear the audio, man, you can hear it in my voice.
Oh,
like,
I'm sure.
I am flipping out big time.
Yeah.
At that point, it was either we lose it. We were both kind of on the verge of losing it mentally,
sure.
our mentality. And then it just, it almost turned into anger at that point because survival kicked in. Mm-hmm. And I literally yelled at Tara, get on the radio and call the Mayday. And the hindsight of that, that's what checked us both back in because it created that line of communication. And then we initiated task orientation, right? In a situation like that, I think it's extremely important to maintain a task, have something to do, especially in a situation where you're completely helpless. So her having just our comm specialist to talk to and have them try to help us sort through things while I'm trying to figure out in my mind how much fuel do we have on board.
Where are you?
Is the altitude hold engaged? Is autopilot functioning? So it's just working through those things. And then unfortunately you get to that point where you feel like you've done everything you can. And then that's when the helplessness really kicks in.
Yeah. And we talked about this yesterday, but we're talking about 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Right?
From skid to skid, it was 8 minutes and it took us, five up in the air to realize there was an issue and call Mayday. And then from that point, 3 to get back down to the ground.
You know, I think the other thing that we have to remember, too, is that you had a patient to take care of as well.
Correct.
So you have an intubated, mechanically ventilated patient. You have climbed over the top of that patient. So that ET tube has to be held as you do that. You know, my
try
big old sausage feed, I'm going to hook a hook on that.
Yeah.
So I think that's where you really have to communicate. And so obviously you did that successfully. The other thing I want to point out is I think, you know, when we've seen crashes, obviously I've never been in an incident like that, but when you see crashes, most crashes are fatal crashes. And I would bet to guess the crew had no idea. Most often, I would hope. The big thing that gets me and gets me emotional thinking about it is you guys had to come to the realization of your own mortality.
Rapidly.
And I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, so the resilience thing, that was one thing that I struggled with personally in the aftermath of it, was there was a point in the flight, and Tara and I talked about it a lot afterwards, and it's actually what kind of drove me to the realization that I need some outside, I need some help here. This is not one of those things where we as type A's, we go through our careers and all the things we see and the things we do, we're so accustomed to just, we'll kick it under the rug because tomorrow's a new day and we got to go back to work. My brain had physiologically accepted the fact that I was going to die at one point in that flight. And I remember just asking just to make it quick so that my family didn't have to. I didn't want my kids and my family to see me suffer. And then to come out on the other side of that and then have to reprocess that moment where your brain has, you've accepted the fact that you're 32 years old and this is just how you're going to go. I struggled with that. I struggled with that realization.
Yeah.
So take us back to, and I loved what you talked about yesterday, and kind of now you're up with a pilot, and you told me, I'm out of my seatbelt, I don't have a helmet on, and the realization of probably crashing, and, you know, that was huge to me, because, you know, you're very unprotected. And so from that point forward, what happened with you guys' communication and how you ended up?
So after the Mayday call, we had some discussion with our communication specialist. We got on with OCC. They were asking if the autopilot was engaged, which is something that we weren't really familiar with, but that's where that communication was good between Lane and I. I would relay things to him, he'd relay back, and we were going back and forth with OCC. And it was almost disheartening at the time as well, because they're asking us questions like, okay, is your autopilot engaged? And then you can just hear in his voice like this sigh of, I don't really know what else to tell you, I don't know what else to do, because essentially in his mind, we're the last people that, like, they're going to talk to. Like, that's,
yeah.
You know, they're just kind of biding their time and biding our time until the unimaginable happens.
I could imagine how helpless that was on their end.
You know,
just trying to keep her comfortable, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Just trying to keep us, you know, as calm and as task-oriented as we could be to essentially take our mind off the fact that our demise is coming shortly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that communication, just that AMRAAM inside the aircraft, but also with our specialists on the outside of the aircraft, was one of the things that really kept us locked in to be able to focus enough not to just flip out and make the situation a lot worse than what it really was.
And so your comms folks did a presentation here yesterday from from their perspective on this whole event, right? Because you guys shared the same event, but you had completely different experiences, obviously, right? But so that sort of goes into that a little bit. So what are some of the highlights that they sort of took or were explaining to people about what happened?
So one thing that struck me on a large scale in the aftermath of that was we understood completely how we felt during that incident.
Yeah.
And then you go and talk to them and realize the helplessness that they felt. And I remember they put it in a perspective for me. They said, you guys' aircraft was moving on our screen, and all we wanted to do was put our finger on it and move it to where we wanted you to be, and then that be the end of it. So there's a time lapse with the SkyTrack system, right? So when we actually finally ended up getting to the ground, initially, immediately started an emergency shutdown procedure. Well, when I started the emergency shutdown procedure and killed battery power, it killed SkyTrack. That time lapse happened in our comm center where our aircraft was moving, and then you can hear it on the recordings where they said, hey, the aircraft's no longer moving, and we have zero airspeed, is what they said. So at that point, they're trying to call us on the radio, they're trying to call us on cell phones, and they can't get a hold of us. And then that communication happens between those guys up there, and you can just hear it in their voice, you know, of what they figured had happened.
Okay, so you're up with a pilot trying to figure out what's going on with him. We know he's having a medical emergency. What were you doing up there, right? You're not a pilot. So I
was trying to just get him to understand what I was trying to tell him. And we were in a very rural area, a lot of farming fields and whatnot. And honestly, I was trying to get him to land in every field that we flew over. We were at about 800 feet AGL, I believe is what it was. And just every field, like I'm just pointing and I'm like, I need you to land the aircraft there. And I'm at that crossroads where I want to try to stay calm because I don't want him to get the perception that I'm like angry with him or trying to fight with him. And then I didn't want to make any kind of movements where he maybe thinks, I don't know what he was perceiving and how he was understanding it. So I'm just trying to get him to land. We were only about 5 minutes from our base. So I tried to get him to go back to our base, thinking that that may spark some familiarity in his mind. And it was just over and over again, he would just put his hands, okay, where? Okay, so where? And then there was a point where he just stared at me. You know, we're still in an obstacle environment, so we're trying to watch for that. And it appeared to me that he was kind of his right arm was kind of on the cyclic, which is in what I believe had us in that left hand turn. So I kind of just went under his hand and just kind of helped him center the cyclic as best as I could. And I've never touched an aircraft controller in flight in my life.
You mentioned yesterday that you couldn't believe how sensitive.
It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. So it's so crazy to go back and think that, like Tara said, we're 5 minutes into the flight, and then from the time we actually initiated the Mayday call until land is 3 minutes. And you could have never convinced me of that.
Thought it was an hour.
It was
longest. Yeah. 3 minutes
we
of your
said
life.
After the fact, we could hear every time the blade swooped by us.
Yeah.
Time was
everything just slows
so
down.
Slow.
You know, so just randomly, I'm sitting up there and I'm legitimately just kind of praying for my life at this point. The bargaining and the
You're going through the whole stages.
100%.
Yeah,
and you're trying to control yourself mentally because you want to get caught in that because you deserve that emotion at that point, but you still have a fight to continue. And then he randomly looks away from me and says the word there. And all I did in my mind was that was different, right? So it kind of like, it checked us back in. I was like, what is he talking about? I looked out and there was a huge yard in between two residences. And I said, yeah, there. And I just told him as calmly as I could, put her down nice and easy.
So before we move on, just so everybody understands, so right-sided, right arm paralysis, had control of his left arm so he could control the collective, had both pedal control, correct?
Correct.
But he was aphasic and almost 100% aphasic. Was he able to get any words out or were they mumbled?
No slurred speech at all, just very, very aphasic.
Just what he was thinking. was not coming out, clearly.
Correct.
Right? I mean, yeah.
Okay. So he's got control. He obviously identifies right there, which was a difference. So go ahead and continue.
So he starts to make a steep approach, very controlled. We talked about that afterwards a lot, in that it was as controlled of a descent as we've ever had inside of an aircraft. And I'm just kind of trying to, you know, hold the cyclic, help him hold the cyclic, because there's so much unknown.
Oh, so the autopilot's been disengaged at this point.
And that was the point where the anxiety went to another level, because I hollered at Tara. I said, he's going for the collective, autopilot's going to disengage. And I told her, this is it. And when I said that, in my mind, either we're going to land or we're going to crash. There's no in between point. You know what I mean? It's coming down to the final moments.
It's just weird that that's the emotion he had at the time.
Yeah.
Because once we started a controlled descent, my anxiety immediately disappeared, because that was something very comfortable and very known to me, was, okay, we're descending in altitude, and it's, I mean, like you said,
it was calm,
everything is good, and this is routine, this is familiar, and I feel good about it. So, I mean, I'm panicking up here, and then we start a descent, which is essentially, that's the life or death moment,
right?
You know,
I'm
when
sure
we get to the
you
ground.
You were not thinking controlled descent. You were thinking we're gonna auger in here, right? And controlled descent doesn't jive with what you had been thinking,
exactly,
probably,
right?
Or what
exactly
we had been experiencing up to that point,
exactly. And so I can totally see why maybe your anxiety sort of dissipated, because you're back in the
great.
In your lane, right? You're back in the what seems to be normal, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, so the whole stress response, when you get into the physiology of a stress response, you know, your prefrontal cortex with, you know, logical thinking and decision making and whatnot. When we got to the ground was wetted. We had some weather, you know, in the previous days. Perfectly controlled descent, skids hit the ground, and then they kind of suction into the ground. So at that point, I initially put the collective all the way to the floor, throttled down, and initiated an emergency shutdown procedure. At the same time, I'm yelling at her, I'm screaming at her to get out the aircraft, because I still don't know. It's the unknown, right? But the logical part of that, you know, the stress response, I'm telling her to get out of the aircraft, because in my mind, I'm trying to protect her. I want her to get out of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And she's like, afterwards, and it doesn't make sense. Why would we get out the aircraft when the blades are still spinning?
Mm.
That's not what we train. Yeah. You know, but the stress response,
you're like,
just
I want out of here.
It was so real.
Yeah.
So he's like, get out. And I'm sitting there now in a controlled state of mind, just because we had such a good landing. I'm like, no, we're still full throttle, like 100%. I'm not getting out of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And immediately that triggered another anxiety response, because I don't know if he's going to yank up on the collective.
Right,
I don't know,
you don't
if,
know
he,
what
if
the
he's going to
jank the patient is, right?
Jank the cyclic. I mean, we can roll over right here on the ground. So this isn't done yet. So that was like my second, something might happen here.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the amazing thing, is that you immediately pushed that collective down. You didn't wait. Did you just hold your arm on that?
I mean, did. I took his hands off of everything, and I held that collective down. And then I immediately killed the fuel switch, and then started flipping all above switches aft, which, you know, going back to training, we'll take double IMC procedures as well. When we're flying those empty legs, that's legitimately things that we talk about on a regular basis. We talk about, we go over the emergency shutdown procedures, throttle, fuel, battery. We train that. Double IMC procedures, we practice those double IMC approach plates. We constantly train each other. Let's not chart at night because of the light adaptation on the laptop screen. We actually had a crew that went double IMC not long ago, and that was a takeaway point that I got from him. Was he's like, man, he said, just always have eyes out. He said, I'll never chart at night again. He said, because when the pilot advised us that we were going double IMC, he immediately closed the laptop and tried to look out the aircraft.
And had nothing.
Couldn't see anything because of light adaptation. He had been looking at a computer screen. So it all goes back to that training, and it comes back full circle. Unfortunately, we can't train for everything, right? So Tara finally gets out the aircraft, and I'll let you tell, you know, once the aircraft actually shut down, I engaged a rotor brake, and then she gets out the aircraft.
Yeah, so the how our 206 is set up, on the left side, I had to walk around the nose and into the pilot door area. By the time it took me to walk out and get there, pilot had already turned the fuel switch and the battery switch back on.
And I'm still stuck in the aircraft.
And he's, Lane is actively trying to get himself out of the position that he was in. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like our pilots start trying to start the aircraft over again. It's like, no, you're not. Turn the fuel switch off, turn the battery off. Hmm. I undid his harness and physically grabbed him and drug him out of the aircraft. And around this time, this is when the phone starts ringing. And this was probably about, I don't know, I think their timeline was like 10 minutes from the point that we had disappeared off the Skytrack to me answering that phone. And they were like, what happened?
Yeah,
like,
what's going on?
We're down.
The fact that you answered probably threw them for a loop.
He's like,
right,
we're
off the
down
bat.
And we're safe. He's like, what do you mean you're down and you're safe? Like, we're fine. Everybody's okay. We're good. And also at the same time, I'm on the phone with him, but I'm having to maintain a physical barrier between the pilot and the aircraft because he's still actively trying to go back to the aircraft.
Well,
we still have this patient on board, right?
Yeah, like you have two patients now.
You don't have a conscious patient. You have a mechanically ventilated patient.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, and that, so as soon as, so she's dealing with that, and I was trying to get out of aircraft as fast as I humanly, you know,
oh,
could.
Oh, yeah, you were done. Spumoni, as I say.
So I immediately get out, and I call our boss, and we have a really good base culture, and I think that's a big takeaway point from this as well, is base culture. I called him, and I'm like, hey, I need you at this location now. This is what happened. And his first words to me, just because of, you know, we're always, he said, Lane, are you kidding me right now? Are you joking? And I'm yelling at him at this point. I don't even have the time of day to joke around with you right now. But, you know, just kind of that funny irony, you know?
Yeah.
So it was shortly after he's where we are. And then EMS starts showing up. And that was one thing that he told me on the phone. He was like, okay, he said, now you have two patients. And in my mind, I was having a hard time wrapping my head around that because I'm still thinking about the fact that, okay, we're here, our feet are on the ground, but it's like we still have a job to do, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot of stress.
All right, so you talked about a few things. First of all, so glad that this whole, just sitting here listening to it is just unbelievable to me. But you had mentioned a few things, Lane, complacency, accountability, and some things. So what are some of the takeaways that you guys have from this particular incident and that you are hoping to share you're going to share your story here at AMTC. But what are the things, like, you want to pass on, you want people to know?
So one of the bigger things that our training department got into after this was getting the med crew familiar with the flight deck. There was some continuing education put out across the company just to get them familiar with what the autopilot is, what does it do, where are the buttons located for it, and then also reiterating the fact that you need to practice your emergency shutdown procedures, you need to go ahead and practice your IIMC approaches and that kinds of stuff, just making sure that you maintain the same level of readiness as a flight crew member as you do being a medical crew member. I mean, we practice airway skills all the time, but when's the last time that you did an emergency shutdown procedure on your aircraft? Yeah. You know, just maintaining that level of comfortability with those procedures because it's comfortable when you practice it. Also on top of that, making sure that, you know, we hold each other accountable, having a good base culture, making sure that your partner is where he or she needs to be before you get the tones. You know, it's not just go time whenever you hear the tones drop. It's always go time before you even walk through the door. And Lane and I, we're very good at just checking our pride at the door. We have a relationship to where if we feel like something's going on with each other, we can be like, hey, what's up? And not need to feel like I'm not stepping into, you know, your personal space.
Right.
Because it's, dude, I'm getting in an aircraft with you. Like, I need you to be squared away.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah, and even, I go back to our pilot a lot. Because from a training aspect, that dedication to excellence, I think he's like a 30-year, like a 30, 35-year pilot, Army veteran, incredible pilot. That training and that consistency and that muscle memory, he's having a CVA, a stroke in an aircraft, and still manages with muscle memory to make a controlled descent of a helicopter.
While having a stroke.
Well, I think that's like, that's the big thing. You said you put your hand underneath his, and as we all know, flying, the hardest part of flying a helicopter is that hover. I mean, flying straight and level is like flying an airplane. It's very simple, but flying to a controlled hover landing, and he already had paralysis. So, you know, we've all watched, and I mean, there's just it's not just fixed; it's moving counter all over. How much of that were you doing?
So I don't believe he had I believe he had more of a paresis on that right side. He's still, you know, it's so hard to actually explain, it's difficult to explain. I can just see it, right?
Yeah.
But the controlled descent, not only with the collective, if he can't control the collective, we're done, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
His muscle memory from years and years and years of flying an aircraft, that's just what he does. And then let's talk about the pedals aircraft.
I know. That's why I asked you if he had the right.
We talked about that yesterday.
Yeah. You know, because that'd be like a stuck pedal.
Exactly.
I mean,
you lose your tail rotor effectiveness, and that's over.
Yeah.
And perfect pedal control. It's mind blowing. You know.
Yeah. To say the least. All right. Cool. Well.
How is the pilot doing?
So, He has recovered.
Yeah.
To my knowledge, he does not have any leftover paresis or anything. Now, as far as speech impediment and those things go, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And I try to just limit myself on how much we speak about
absolutely.
That.
Still, he's still ongoing. Medical treatment, and to this day, he's not back flying as of yet.
So let's come back to our patients. Now you have the pilot, and now you still have your patient, right? And so you have a continuum of care that you have to maintain. What did you do with your patient in the aircraft?
So while we were on comms with dispatch, they actually dispatched our closest base, neighboring base, which is probably about 20 minutes away from us, and they were inbound to the scene, but also they dispatched through the emergency response network in Louisiana. So there were actually four different aircraft from multiple agencies and multiple ground units from multiple agencies around the area that
converged.
Correct. Because they were preparing to roll up on the scene of a catastrophe, basically.
Yeah. To do a recovery.
Sure.
Correct. It's funny now because the ground crew that we initiated the call with, our first patient with, was actually the ground crew that came back transport the pilot and myself to the nearest facility for him. Yeah.
And the first thing they told us when they got out the unit, they said when they called us back and said that you guys were about to go down, we couldn't believe it because they were like, we just saw you, you know, and you left and you were fine. But that's how fast things happen.
Yeah.
Right. So Tara ended up going in the ground unit with our pilot, and so we ended up splitting up. And then once we got on the ground and ground EMS arrived, I want to say our secondary aircraft was probably about 10 minutes out or so. So I stayed with the patient, and you know, for me, hindsight looking back on that, for me, I think that's probably what kind of grounded me again. Because it created that normalcy again for me. Because patient care is normal for us. That's what we do. That's our comfort zone. So that's what I went back to. Not only because I had to, but in my mind, it just created that normalcy again.
Yeah, it was cathartic for you.
I started checking, making sure the airway was still secure, making sure my vent was still operating appropriately, continuing post-intubation management, making sure that we were still, you know, everything was still fine on our monitor.
Yeah, your aircraft battery is shut off, and you have, I mean, there are so many parts of that are, you know, do you have, there's so many parts.
Did the ELT go off, or did you guys turn it on, or how did that?
So we turned it on.
We activated it.
And they said in the communication system that they couldn't pick us up on it.
For some reason, we weren't pinging
on
it. And yeah, that was kind of a mystery in the aftermath of it.
Yeah.
But I remember pushing it. I looked at it on the collective, and we activated it.
I think that, you know, one point I'd like to bring up, and I think this is the what differentiates our profession, military, is you have these massive secondary stress responses. I mean, imagine the lay public in a aircraft crash. You know, and you always hear of a doctor, a nurse, a paramedic, you know, stepping up and then providing aid is obviously we don't have a choice in that situation, especially on duty. You have a patient that's active, and to have to push all that down deep and reset.
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, so you have your acute stress response, you have your delayed stress response, then you have your cumulative stress response, and then ultimately your PTSD.
Yeah.
What we experienced, we have an incredible peer support team and CISM program at our company. Our company psychologist is an incredible human being. And basically, all she came and did was not talk about our feelings, not want to know how we felt about everything, but just normalized our reaction. Broke down the physiology of why we were feeling the way we were feeling. Yeah. And she went to, you guys are having a delayed stress response, and here's what a delayed stress response is. And just to have that normalized for people like us who are type A's, we have to know the why and everything, and we don't like to talk about our feelings.
Yeah.
Don't ask me about the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. I don't want to talk to you about that because you're not going to understand it, kind of thing. So normalizing that, to me, that's what got us back on that track of, you know, we can get through. We're going to get through this.
Yeah.
But it was definitely recognizing that something was off after the fact. You know, we had a meeting about it probably, what, a month after it had happened. And it was the first time either of us had heard the tapes.
Mm.
And
so that just
that was
brought
like,
everything right back,
right,
I'm sure.
About a week or so later, both on our own accords, contacted our CISM team and got with our psychologist just because we knew we're not right. Something's not right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest takeaways that we want to sort of emphasize after, you know, everything that happened, is that it's okay. It's okay to feel bad. It's okay doing these things that we do.
Yeah.
You know, everybody bundles that up and puts it away, and it's just because I have the next one, you know. That's not how it needs to be. And you're not soft if you need to get help. You're not weak.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to. Yeah.
And I had never heard the tapes because I had to take my helmet off
to get
to the front of the aircraft. And, you know, the first time when I listened to the tapes and I heard her call Mayday over the radio, oh man, that was difficult. I needed to hear that to close some loops. You know, there's a part of that flight that I still to this day can't remember. Mm. Because of the severity of the incident, my brain did a data dump on the irrelevant, what my brain considered to be irrelevant.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So we listened to the tapes and I was like, oh my God. Hindsight, I'm glad I didn't have to listen to that with my helmet on in the aircraft because
at
I think it
time,
would have been an additional distraction
for sure.
And I don't know how things may have changed had I been able to hear her on the radio that day.
And how much time did you guys take off? Did you take any time off?
We took about a week or so off, and after that, I mean, we were both just ready to get back to work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Ready to have a little bit normalcy because everyone is like, call it tata and down south, where they just want to kind of put
console.
You in and console and you don't
you were sort of done with that
we're
that
ready
point.
To go like I'm ready to be back in the aircraft.
Yes.
So we took a ferry flight up, actually flew over the scene, did a little bit of a
sort of a debrief, you know, or discussion,
refamiliation
or
around it, and we were good. Got flights in not that long after that, continuing to roll on our normal ops, but still had that lingering, you know, something serious just happened to me, and the, like Lane was saying, that delayed stress response was starting to get to
us. That was one thing that I asked Lane about yesterday, well both of you, but what was life sort of post-event back in the saddle, like, did you find yourself a little more sensitive to a noise or to a situation or a vibration or if the pilot did isolate you, right?
So what was that like? During the ferry flight, we actually practiced an approach into one of the local airports, and there was traffic in the pattern, and our pilot actually isolated us just for a second. And it took him 2 seconds longer than I was comfortable with to respond back to me. And that was like, oh my God, here we go again. You know? And he came back up and he's like, hey, sorry, I had to isolate you. I was like, that's fine. Just let me know, please.
Yeah, tell us before.
Just let me know. And I mean, you just kind of like pucker up a little bit and then you're like, okay, we're good. But that was the only thing for me was just that isolation, just because that's how it all started.
Right.
You know, that it was almost the beginning of the snowball all over again.
Mm-hmm. And for me, I initially, so we had survivor high in the initial phase after that. I didn't rest well for about 4 days.
Oh, I'm sure.
But initially, we talked about it after. We met up the day after just to kind of, we almost just kind of wanted to be with each other.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, but you sort of shared a thing.
Yeah.
I felt invincible almost. Like, yeah. I'd get in my truck and I wanted to drive my truck 100 miles an hour because I felt like nothing's gonna go wrong here. Like I've surpassed the big one, kind of thing. And then, physiologically, we were struggling with transferring a severe incident like that from short term to long term memory.
Yeah.
We were struggling with that. That created a really hypersensitive state for me, both at work and at home, to the point where my personal life was actually suffering.
Sure.
My family life was suffering. And I mean, hypersensitive like no one should be.
It's a stuff that doesn't matter, as you were saying, right?
Exactly. Like, you know, the small things are huge things. And I didn't want to deal with it. I couldn't deal with it. And initially, I didn't understand why. And my wife is like, you know, you're just an a-hole kind of thing, right? And I'm thinking to myself, I am, you know? And then you get to that point where you have to self-reflect. And you have to reevaluate what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it's an incredible story. Lane and Tara, thank you guys so much for swinging by, sharing your story. I can't wait for people to hear this. Good luck with your talk tomorrow.
Thank you.
And God bless you guys. And we appreciate you stopping by.
Yeah. If you need help, get help. Yeah. Don't be afraid. You know, we have to check pride. And I tell people a lot, we focus and exert so much energy and effort and time into taking care of everyone else.
Right.
We have to exert that same energy, focus, and time in taking care of ourselves. I think that's where we fall short as individuals in this profession.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Well, on behalf of everybody at Flatbird Jet, I just want to thank you for joining us, and big honor to have you tell the story. And I, you know, I'm excited that everybody's going to get to hear this that didn't come to AMTC. So appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, all right.
This has been a production of the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.